This is a download of Farming Today from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk. The presenter today, Charlotte Smith.
Good morning. Today, a ban on slug pellets and the environment gets a new watchdog. But we start with food. It's one of the busiest weeks of the year for food producers. And all this week, we're looking at how different farming businesses are making the most of it. Well, for pork producers, sausage making goes into overdrive. What's Christmas without chipolatas, pigs in blankets and stuffing? Sarah Falkingham paid an early morning call to Moss Valley Fine Meats on the edge of Sheffield.
There's a beautiful golden sun just rising over the fields here on the edge of Sheffield. We're only a few hundred yards from the ring road, but we're actually deep into countryside. And I'm with Stephen Thompson on his farm, where there's a butchery on site. And we're just going to go into the butchery, where before the sun came up, three butchers started their shift at 6:30 to get ready for Christmas week. We're coming down to the corridor here, where there's lots of slicing and dicing and chopping going on, Stephen.
We're chopping up shoulders here, ready to go out to one of our Mexican outlets today.
You make 1,000 chipolatas a week alone just for Chatsworth House.
Yes.
I think that's incredible. How many sausages do you think you're making for Christmas?
For Christmas, thousands and thousands of little sausages. We do probably 0.5 tonne of sausage a week in any case, but it'll go up to 0.75 tonne this time of the year. And it's just back-to-back days now, really, through to Christmas.
Are you doing pigs in blankets then?
We do little sausages, we do streaky bacon, and we give people kits to make because we would just be here 24 hours a day, 7 days a week making them. We just gave up after the first year because it's just not... We were hardly doing anything then compared to now. We'd want thousands of people making them.
Is it really fiddly? I have heard of people that make pigs in blankets says it's just a thankless task.
Oh, it is, yes. Your fingers lock up after about 30 minutes and it's just not worth it.
And what about flavours? Everyone expects a different sausage for Christmas, don't they?
We do 30-odd varieties in any case, but then for Christmas we've got Christmas cracker, we've got cranberry and rosemary.
What's Christmas cracker?
Christmas cracker has got apricots and different flavours in there, so that's a nice mixture of everything Christmas. And then we do plum and mulled wine. It's just like a glass of mulled wine, but with a sausage with it, so it's beautiful, and that's flying out.
How lucrative do you think Christmas is for your business?
It's probably 20% up on the rest of the months in the year. January just carries on, though, so for us, really, because people keep eating. So it just makes us very busy, and we make some extra money and put more pigs through the butchery this time of the year.
A lot of four-quarter meat is used in the sausages. Is that helpful as a producer? Because a lot of people they like the hams and the legs, but to use the four-quarter meat up in the sausage meat must be a bonus.
Yeah, well, we have to balance the carcass every week because we don't buy and sell meat to other people. We just use our own meat, so that everything here is ours. So we have to kind of balance the carcass, so anything that we need to goes into sausage, all the trimmings, and some shoulder, bit of leg. So, yes, so at the end of the day, we need to balance the carcass because we can't do it any other way, really.
Stephen Thompson there on Christmas sausages. More about Christmas food tomorrow. Now, we talk about a very wide variety of stuff here on Farming Today, and prompted by some of your questions, we've decided to devote a whole programme to answering all the farming queries you've ever had, or at least as many of them as we can fit in. This is a fairly typical one, a question about the slaughter of pigs, which came in after an item we ran asking how humane the use of carbon dioxide gas is. It's used to render the pigs unconscious before slaughter. Well, we heard from Dr. Dorothy McKeegan from the University of Glasgow about her research into an alternative method using low atmospheric pressure stunning. Well, after that programme, listener Nick Tyrrell got in touch to ask why nitrogen gas isn't used instead. We didn't know, so Heather Simons got back in touch with Dr. McKeegan to find out.
Well, it's a really good question, and nitrogen has been explored as a possible option for gas stunning of animals prior to slaughter. But the problem is that it has the same density as air, so it's very difficult technically to get the oxygen concentration low enough to achieve an effective stun.
So how do they do it with carbon dioxide at the moment then?
Well, the carbon dioxide is in a pit, so because carbon dioxide is heavier than air, it'll stay in a pit and the animals are lowered into it.
But the nitrogen doesn't sink, so you couldn't get a pit full of it.
It would never exclude oxygen to the right amount.
And what about if you've got a sealed unit which has the low pressure inside it? Could that not be used for nitrogen instead of the low pressure atmosphere?
Well, again, the problem is that as you bring animals into that controlled atmosphere, they're bringing in air and oxygen with them. And then once you seal the chamber, it's very difficult to remove the oxygen.
So I guess you'd almost need to kind of create the low pressure atmosphere in the first place just to replace it all with nitrogen anyway. So you may as well just use that.
Exactly, yeah. So it's just technically really difficult to do.
Dr. Dorothy McKeegan there. So on New Year's Day, do tune in or catch up later on BBC Sounds to hear more answers to more of your questions. Metaldehyde is to be banned. In an announcement which surprised many in the industry, the government says the slug killer, which is widely used by both farmers and gardeners, will be banned for outdoor use from the spring of 2020. DEFRA says it took the decision following expert advice that metaldehyde poses an unacceptable risk to birds and mammals. While the National Farmers Union describes the decision as hugely disappointing, warning it'll have a major impact on British farmers. The industry set up a metaldehyde stewardship group in 2008. It's campaigned to get farmers to use fewer slug pellets more carefully, paying particular attention to keeping metaldehyde out of streams and rivers, and it says use has fallen. Colin Myram is an agronomist and a consultant to the group. He says they were expecting a consultation on the future of metaldehyde, but not a ban.
Well, I think it's a very sad day for British agriculture, particularly after 70 years of usage of the product. It is a very important loss of an active ingredient, which is used for the control of the major pest in UK agriculture and horticulture.
And yet the government says it simply poses an unacceptable risk to birds and mammals.
That is the area in which the authorisation has been withdrawn. But in fact, all through the years of wildlife incident investigations over the last 20 or 30 years, from advised, recommended usage, there have never, ever been a problem. So we do fail to see exactly why it's such an issue. Particularly as in other parts of Europe, I think in 21 other countries, it is being used and is still authorised, which of course will put British farmers and growers, again, at a competitive disadvantage.
It has, though, been long acknowledged that there are problems with metaldehyde. That's why there is such a thing as the metaldehyde stewardship groups. And we've reported over the years on many projects where water companies are working with farmers, where environmentalists are working with farmers to try and manage its use and cut its use. We can't pretend that this has ever been an easy product.
The water issue was being addressed and has been addressed via the water companies, and therefore there's no reason for this withdrawal on the basis of the water issue alone.
And indeed, the government doesn't in fact mention that, although water companies, I think, would point out it has been expensive and continues to be to get metaldehyde out of the water.
And if you look at the results this year, for example, we've had very few, if any, exceedances in surface water, and indeed, certainly none at the tap.
In a statement, the Environment Secretary Michael Gove says that he recognises significant effort has been put in to encouraging growers and gardeners to use it responsibly. But he says the advice is clear that the risks to wildlife are simply too great and we must all play our part in helping to protect the environment. So, he says, metaldehyde will now be phased out over 18 months to give growers time to adjust. And he says he encourages companies and growers to look at the alternatives. What are the alternatives?
Well, I'm afraid there's only one, which is ferric phosphate. If we get resistance of slugs to ferric phosphate, then we have no options. There is a nematode which can be used on small areas of garden crops and so on, which is very, very expensive and cannot be used on broadacre crops.
Just explain what a nematode is.
It's a very small worm which attacks slugs.
Why do you think the government has done this now?
I think you better ask the government why they've done it now. The amount of work that's gone into to showing that it is still a very effective and safe product, I personally am pretty sad that it's come to this announcement.
Colin Myram. Plans for a new environment watchdog, which will have the power to take the government to court, have been announced. It's just one of the measures outlined by ministers in the long-awaited Environment Bill, which has just been published. The Secretary of State, Michael Gove, says it places environmental ambition and accountability at the heart of government and will create a pioneering new system of green governance. So what does all that actually mean? Ruth Chambers is from Greener UK.
Well, look, there's a really sort of good story to be told here in that the government has set out its ambition very clearly. However, on the other side, there's a real risk that the protections that we have at the moment are at risk of being weakened for a number of reasons. The first reason is that the new body that the government is proposing to set up to hold it to account in the future is not going to be properly independent. And the second reason is the mechanism by which that body will be able to take the government to court if it fails in its compliance with environmental law, we think could be weaker than what we have at the moment.
Well, let's take the first one first. This new body, the Office for Environmental Protection, is described by the government as an independent watchdog, which will sit on top of existing Environment Agency, Natural England and devolved bodies. What's wrong with that?
Warm words alone do not make an independent body. And I think there are two matters in particular in the draft bill where the new body will fall down short of being properly independent of government. The first one of those is on funding. The funding of the budgets for the new body will be basically controlled by government ministers in the future. So the body will get what money government decides it will get. And the second is on the appointment. So this body, like all other public bodies similar in nature, will have a board of members. All of those members, including the chair, will be appointed by the Secretary of State. And we know from our examination of other public bodies in this space that those are two critical matters to ensure independence in doers over the long term. And the bill, unfortunately, doesn't deliver those to the proper degree.
Now, ministers are making much of the fact that this body can take them to court. You're not convinced about that, though?
It can take them to court, but it's by a different mechanism that exists at the moment. So we want more time to have a look at whether or not that mechanism is truly going to be good enough to ensure that there's not just the process of a government being taken to court, but actually that process of going to court will result in a change of heart and a change of decision by that government. So if a breach of environmental law is found, that breach will be dealt with and the government or the public body in question will then be required to act in a different way.
This covers quite a lot, this draft bill. It, for instance, puts environmental principles like polluter pays into law. It also makes it a legal requirement for the government to have a plan to improve the environment. But quite a lot of it is quite vague.
I think it's quite vague, but it is a draft bill. So on the plus side, we now have the next 3 months to work with parliamentarians, to work with the government, to turn what in some cases is a little bit vague into much more robust and ambitious policy and legislation before the wider bill is introduced into Parliament. And I think we have to remember the government wants to set out a pioneering path to ensure that our environmental protections are delivered and are made stronger in the long term. We're absolutely with it on that journey, but we have to remember we're at the start of that journey and there's an awful lot of work to do before we get to the end of it.
Is there time to do that work? Because other green groups have suggested that there are loopholes and they're not confident that civil servants will have the time, given everything else that's going on at the moment, to actually plug those.
It is an ambitious timetable, but it's a timetable that we think is necessary because what we don't want to see is a governance gap after the UK leaves the European Union. And without this bill passing at a sort of swift pace, then we would have that gap. So we support the timescale that the government set out. It needs to be tested with and supported by stakeholders, including environmental NGOs and other members of civil society.
Ruth Chambers there from Greener UK. Much more on that over the next few weeks. But that's it from us. I'm Charlotte Smith, and the producer in Bristol was Alan Beach.